You're listening to Sustainable, the podcast, inspiring action to help create a sustainable world for people serious about creating change. With your host, Tabitha Jane, director and lead coach at Earth Self.
Today on Sustainable, I'm speaking to Catherine Trebeck from the Wellbeing Economy Alliance Scotland. Yeah?
Yep.
Excellent. It is so great to have you here today, Catherine. Can you just tell us a little bit more about the Wellbeing Economy Alliance Scotland before we get started?
So Wellbeing Economy Alliance Scotland, which nicely shortens to We All, is the Scottish hub of a global collaboration. So there's a global piece, and then there's a Scottish iteration. There's also local hubs bubbling up in places like Canada and New Zealand and Costa Rica as well. And what connects all those hubs is that they're groups of people and organizations who are really diverse, but united by the sense that if we're going to have a chance to change and address the challenges facing the world, we have to transform the economic system. And to do that, we need to collaborate like we've never collaborated before. And so the origins of We All were some organizations coming together just a few years ago. So we're still relatively new, but saying, one, we've got to transform the economic system, make it more humane, more sustainable. But a lot of people have been working on that for many years, whether it's scholars, whether it's activists, whether it's community groups, whether it's businesses. There's lots going on in that space. But to date, that's been insufficiently linked up and connected, and hence not packing the punch in the system change that we need it to pack. So what we're about is linking those groups together, amplifying the work that's happening, channeling some of the messages up to policymakers to try and get the policy regime to be more favorable to this sort of work. So it's very diverse and exciting, challenging, because collaboration is difficult, but we're getting there. So we're about 2 years old now. And then the Scottish iteration is bringing that down to what's the potential for Scotland? What are the questions that Scotland needs to ask? What can Scotland learn from being part of that global movement? But also the global movement has its eye on Scotland too, because there's a lot of really interesting developments happening here in Scotland. So it's a bit of a moment, I think, for Scotland in these conversations about economic transformation.
I like that, because I get the sense that, you know, there's something happening in Scotland. And I suppose there's two ways to kind of explore where the conversation goes, because I am really curious, and I've realised that my first question that I wanted to start with this, we probably need to take a step back and explain what a wellbeing economy is first. And then where I'm really curious, I want to get into the conversation today, is how a wellbeing economy can help us recover from COVID-19 crisis and what that would look like.
So wellbeing economy at its most basic is a repurposing of how the economy operates to make it much more focused and delivering for human and ecological wellbeing. For decades, we've had an economic system that has been designed around faster economic growth and all the changes that that leads to in terms of business design, how we do subsidies, how we do the tax system, how we do work regulations, how we design infrastructure and cities, have largely been in pursuit of faster GDP, gross domestic product, out of the assumption sometimes that that is what led to quality of life for people. Mm. And yet that assumption is breaking down in so many places, and we can dig into that later perhaps. But a wellbeing economy is saying, well, we need the economy to be squarely focused on delivering human and ecological wellbeing. And that means a different purpose for the economy at that top macro level, but flowing down from that, it means different business models that have got a different purpose at their heart. It means different ways of designing the tax system. It means we need to rethink work in terms of quality of jobs, payment, what sort of work we remunerate and in what ways, how we share work. So it's a really, really complex, I talk about it as being a bit of a jigsaw of changes. I squirm a bit when often I get asked, what's the one thing you would do? And it's so much more complicated than that. This is about changing at all layers of the economic system. When it boils down to it, a wellbeing economy is about having humanity and the goals of humanity determine economics rather than the other way around.
Mm. And I think it's really useful, because I've been reading some of the stuff before we had this conversation, and what I liked in terms of helping me really get a clear picture of what the wellbeing economy is was even looking at the traditional idea of sustainable development as these three pillars of economic, social, and environmental good. And then that's been changed into a circular image with, I've changed it into my own view, but having the earth, and then sitting within the earth, we've got humans, and then sitting within us is the economic system that sustains both us and the earth.
And that's quite a profound mindset shift for people to realize that the economy is not on a par with nature and society, which is the traditional way of viewing sustainable development. It's actually recognizing that in reality, the economy is a subset of society. There is so much that goes on in society that contributes to the economy that's not counted by our mainstream fundamental economic measures. And beyond that, those two set spheres of life are a subset of nature. And to shift that thinking, and diagrammatically people can imagine it, it's from those pillars to nested circles, if you like. That's a very, very different way of looking at the world and looking at the economy and looking at the purpose of the economy, because it's about really understanding we can't keep extracting from nature, we can't keep extracting from society without there being grave consequences. And it's about then saying, what sort of economy do we need to design and to create to serve those higher order goals of societal flourishing on a sustainable planet? So it's a really profound shift that I think, but really vital and urgently needed. And of course, ecological economists and feminist economists have been saying this for decades. This isn't new. It's, you know, it's inherent in indigenous thinking, you know, for centuries. But I think people are now, that conversation's now starting to go a little bit more global and more mainstream.
I like it, because I mean, I've always had the issues with the pillars, because it creates this separation between us and nature, which is something that seems to be reinforced. And fundamentally, I mean, what I'm hearing even you say in that description there is it's actually just about time that we recognise that we are part of nature and start acting in accordance with what's needed to ensure that we all sustain life on the planet.
Exactly. And I think one thing that's really been, and we're going to talk about Corona shortly, but one thing that's been so obvious, even just in a short period of few weeks, when we reduce normal economic activity, the rushing about, the going to meetings, the driving our cars around, just everyday people, you know, in communities across the country are noticing nature comes back very quickly. People are noticing bird songs, they're noticing the cleaner rivers in their city, and they're noticing the air being crisper. And I think that's I can talk for ages about how you can't completely decouple environmental impact from economic growth. I think people are seeing that immediately in their communities these last few weeks, just how closely correlated environmental impact is with economic activity. So we need to find a way of designing the economy differently as we emerge beyond Corona that doesn't have the sort of environmental impact that the economy had as we went into Corona.
Yeah, and I think it's great. And that decoupling of economics from resources is something that I do want to come back to, because I've been reading a sentence with that and I was like, oh, there's something just so wrong with the way that that's written there. And I'll appreciate you to share more about that. But let's get back to, now that we've got an understanding of a well-being economy, which is really about helping us all work together as part of the natural world and sustain life in a way that works for everybody. How then, seeing that we're in this moment of, we've seen the slowing down, we've seen how quickly nature is coming back, we're recognizing that there's going to be huge economic challenges as we move into this place of recovery, how can then this well-being economy help us recover?
So I think the well-being economy agenda gives us a really lovely alternative destination to that frantic return to business as usual. And my great anxiety is that once the emergency of the health response is dealt with and managed, and we start to see what's going on in our health systems and our hospitals enable us to start lifting the lockdown, I worry, and I'm really quite anxious, that there's going to be a conversation around quick, how do we get back to normal? How do we get back to business as usual? How do we say that Britain or whatever country people are in is open for business again? And the fear of that is it won't just be business as usual. It will be more fierce and more ferocious than business as usual. It'll be worse for the environment, worse for people. We'll have another worse round of austerity than we did have coming out of the global financial crisis 10 years ago. So my fear is it's not just business as usual, but it'll be even one that's more destructive for people and planet. Even that, I think what the good thing about, I mean, I'm really hesitant to say there are good things about Corona, but one of the things that it has done is pulled back the covers on the nature of the economic system that we had going into it, because I think it's become so patently clear to so many people that the economic system pre-corona, or BC, as someone's now saying, BC, is one that was standing on the shoulders of an army of very lowly paid, fairly disrespected workers in precarious jobs, where they were treated as just-in-time inventory. Everyone talks about just-in-time inventory as a business methodology, and you know, you only have as much inventories in your storehouse as you need for the next day. Human beings were being treated like that. They're on demand at the click of an app, quite literally through the gig economy. And yet human beings require relationships. They require certainty. They require security. We know that security and certainty is one of the most vital fundamental human needs, let alone dignity and sense of purpose. And yet we know that we had an economy that was standing on the shoulders of so many workers who didn't have any of that, who were lowly paid, probably still struggling to put food on the table, often people in jobs turning to food banks and not treated as human beings. And lo and behold, these are the ones who are keeping things going when the rest of us who are fortunate enough to shift to our kitchen tables, the workers who really matter in the economy, are the ones who are delivering to us, delivering to our kitchen tables. So I think one of the conversations that Corona has opened up is a recognition of that. And I hope that we don't return to saying, well, thanks, you've got us through Corona, but we're going to keep paying you poverty wages and treating you as just-in-time inventory. I think the possibility where the wellbeing economy really comes into its own is starting to show and tell the story about something better than what we had going into it. Because I think people are now, as I said, really realizing what we had going into it wasn't good enough. And the wellbeing economy is a potential picture, a potential destination for what we can try to, we're talking about building back better, which is a term that comes from humanitarian work. And I think that's the symbolism of that is quite profound. If we build back better to a wellbeing economy, then we can have an economic system that is much more equal, that delivers dignity, that regenerates a natural planet, that addresses those huge extremes of inequality, of wealth or power, that has a greater sense of connectedness, that is community up rather than extractive economic models. So it's a long answer, but I think, and I'm not insisting on the term wellbeing economy. A lot of people are utilizing it, really liking it, but there's lots of ideas about that. But all they have at their core is this idea that the economy should serve people and planet. And I think that's the vision that we can really hold on to as we build back.
Mm, I like it, because what I'm hearing you say here is, you know, there is this real fear that we as humans, because we're coming from a place of not having our needs met, of this certainty and safety, are going to move into knee-jerk reactions, which is in effect a state of panic, to try and get back some form of safety, of security, going back to a sense of normal, which could unwittingly put us into a cycle of creating more damage, more trauma for us, for the planet, instead of moving into something new. And what I think is really, really powerful in terms of, if I was to summarize your answer into, well, how can a well-being economy help us recover from the COVID-19 crisis? There was two words that came up: value and vision. So what the well-being economy is really offering us is a vision of a better world that we can hold on to, and we can redetermine what we value, i.e. what's important, to ensure that we get there.
Yeah, entirely, entirely. There's a very practical concern too at the policy level, and that's about how do we pay for all the measures that are being enacted now. And I think quite rightly, governments around the world throwing out political ideology. I mean, the tables of political sides are going to be fascinated by this era for decades to come. There are going to be so many books written about what happened when you saw a Tory chancellor saying we are going to pay wages. I mean, it just extraordinary, necessary, completely, but just extraordinary, given that 6 weeks ago, those sorts of conversations would have been laughed at and dismissed as politically unfeasible. So the big thing in terms of practical politics emerging from that is, how do we pay for that level of unprecedented government intervention? And practically, if we have to start talking about things like wealth taxes, land taxes, resource extraction taxes, clamping down on tax evasion and avoidance, because if we don't, we're just going to, it'll be debt funded. And then the risk is that when we return, if, this is my fear again, if we return to the same sort of political discussion that came in after the 2008 financial crisis, that was quick, we've got to pay back that debt. And that was what gave the supposed rationale for that austerity. And so I think the wellbeing economy, again, I think offers some of those really practical solutions in, well, we can't just pay for this through debt and then try to recoup that through fierce austerity that will hurt the poorest, most vulnerable, the hardest. We need to actually have a look around, where is wealth? Maybe we're going to have to start talking about a windfall wealth tax on those tech companies that are doing relatively well out of this. I mean, come on, Jeff Bezos has to be first in line to be tapping.
1.1 trillion. I was reading that. That's how much Amazon is now valued. Like, and this was today, I was reading that and I was like, wow.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, that's where we have to go forward. We cannot resource the emergency and the recovery from the bank accounts of those who don't have anything in them. We have to resource it from the bank accounts of people who are doing well out of this system. And that's also part of that, but that's also part of rebalancing the huge levels of inequality. And it's a key pillar that I think the wellbeing economy starts to offer some quite practical examples for policymakers around how do we pay for all this.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting because you're talking about that gap, and it's such an interesting place to be sitting, because some people are like, no, that gap's fine. It's all right. People make money. They're entitled to keep it. And yet what I suppose is another word that's coming up for me listening to you is responsibility. It's recognizing that even if you are doing well, you're not an individual. You know, the idea that the man is an island was never true anyway. But the idea that you're doing well and you're completely separate from everything else, from people, from planet, is a complete illusion. So if you're depending on them for you to do well, you know, and it comes back to, you know, I think a lot about Andrew Carnegie, who, you know, as people know, came from Scotland, went over to the US, built his big empire, and then all of a sudden went, hey, now we've got a responsibility. Yeah. I think he had a bit of a wake-up call as he realized how badly he was treating some of his staff, from my understanding of him.
And he's lovely for the man who dies wealthy is a man who dies ashamed, or some form of that sentiment as well. And so he really tried to give away so much of his.
Yeah.
And he actually, his foundations that he created have the goal of well-being in their charters from day one.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're really seeing there. So, I mean, how do we encourage people to want to give back more? I mean, my perception is, and, you know, sometimes that's my Pollyanna thinking, I see so many people who are prepared to give back and make it part of what they're doing. So how do we continue to amplify that and help maybe those who are doing a lot better see the benefit of it as well?
So there's a couple of so many layers to that question. It's been one of my favorite topics of conversation. I was obsessed a couple of years ago with a brilliant TV show, and it was a complete rip-off of The West Wing, but it had a female president, and it, for whatever reason, it didn't become the success I thought it should have. But there was a phrase in there by a character played by Donald Sutherland, and he was the sort of sinister person in the you know, from the other side of politics, who was trying to bring down this female president. At one point, though, he had this amazing sentence, and he just said, if someone gives you crumbs, it means somewhere they have a loaf. That really stuck in my mind, because it really speaks to the discomfort I have of this give back agenda, because it means if someone's giving back, it means they took something. And I think we've got to really think about, is it okay for people to do the Carnegie thing or to do the Bezos thing and to make loads of money, but in doing so cause a lot of damage, and then say, oh, I'm going to give back a little bit through philanthropy or charity, which to me seems a little bit about have some crumbs because I've made this loaf. And to me, that's part of my discomfort about the conversations of around charity and philanthropy and wealth that we've seen in the last few decades. I think we need to have a more ambitious, bolder conversation about the way business is done and the value share, the distribution of value share within firms. Not just saying it's okay for great wealth to be extracted to go to shareholders so that they make money through their rents, essentially, and then give it back through a little bit of charitable giving. And I think, you know, we know how harmful economic inequality is, particularly on our politics. I think this is the sort of, often people don't think of those sinister layers of how inequality seeps into our politics and just then reinforces the rules of the game. One of the great systems thinkers, who I'm sure you'll be a fan of, Donella Meadows, talks about success to the successful, because if you've got wealth, you can pay your accountants and your kids to amazing schools, you can lean on your political lobby groups and so on. And I'm not saying everyone does this, of course not, but there is some really sinister work being done behind the scenes. And there's, you know, the amazing philanthropists that we see that are the often the exception that proves the rule. There's been work done analyzing the behavior of the billionaires, and the famous ones, that the good news stories, the hero billionaires who do try to invest in communities and do recognize their great privilege, they're the exception, sadly. The other piece around it is, I think it speaks to your point around no man being an island or no woman being an island, is this conversation around recognizing this idea of entrepreneurialism. And the sort of the economist Mariana Mazzucato has done amazing work just really going into bat for the role of government in terms of economic success, saying so much of that basic research and development that underpins, you know, vaccines, that underpins technological advances, that underpins great advances in infrastructure, for example, so much of that stands, again, on the shoulders of fairly bread and butter basic research and development that is funded by government. Amazon could not do its job if we didn't have the state paying for roads and street lighting and healthy workers, all those things. And so it just makes then the tax evasion by companies like that even more egregious when you think about the sort of the foundations of their economic success. And so I think there is a conversation to be had, really. And I hope where we are at the moment with Corona, recognizing just how vital that the state is might open up a richer conversation around that. Yes, there are some really creative people and there are some extraordinarily talented people, but even their ability to make the most of that depends on collective institutions. Another really interesting point is, and if we're talking about extreme wealth, is how many of the billionaires, there's just over 2,000 billionaires in the world. And there's been analysis done by Oxfam America looking at the source of their wealth. And 2/3, they estimate, of billionaires have made their money from either inheritance or from businesses that are linked to crony capitalism. So you can think of Carlos Slim, for example, in Mexico, with, you know, making the money out of the telecom system and industries that have links to government where you can create monopolies and so on. So 1/3, yeah, amazing people creating products that probably make the world a better place. But I think there's a sort of a serious grain of salt when we hear people say self-made billionaires, wealth creators and so on. We need to sort of take a second look at that.
I think that's really powerful what you just said there of let's take a step back, because I know that I've always toyed going into business development where I set a fine line where it's like, no, we want to be building wealth, and, you know, we tout people who are wealthy and successful because they've achieved it, and there's a whole lot of ideology behind that. Yes, that's what we want to do, and exactly as you've highlighted, this is what, you know, what people are doing to get there. And what I think is really powerful, you know, that self-made billionaire, there's no such thing as a self-made billionaire because it's been supported by many things that we're not valuing and accounting for. And I think you could do a really beautiful example there with Amazon of, wait a minute, how much are you actually contributing towards the roads that you use in order to deliver your services? How much are you accounting for all sorts of other aspects? And that is, how do we account for what we're truly using within our businesses? You know, and I've recognized this over the last 10 years of building a business, because you mentioned that question. Is it that we create something and, you know, destroy and then go, hey, we've arrived and we give back? And that's always bothered me. And I've thought, well, I want to build a business. I want to do it well.
Yeah.
But how do I do it in a way that does good every single step of the way? And what would it look like? You know, that's the question that drives me. What would it look like to create a billion-dollar business that does good from the start? I have no idea, but, you know, that's the question and the exploration that I engage in through what I'm doing, but it requires a lot of different thinking.
And it takes you down the conversation of ownership structures, of governance, of purpose, of incentives, of timeframes. You know, it's really into the heart of the DNA of business. And I think we've got a lot of business models that are structured in a way where their purpose is to extract wealth from workers, for communities, or from environment, and give them to the returns to people who have already got wealth because they're lucky enough to invest in those companies through their shareholders. And if we take Thomas Piketty's work seriously, the idea that inequality grows up when the returns on wealth are greater than the returns on growth, basically we think, hang on, we've got a whole lot of business models that are designed in a way to create inequality. Now that, if we really take that seriously, say, well, okay, then we have to transform how a value share is distributed within a firm. And that's where I think business models such as cooperatives, worker cooperatives or community cooperatives that have been around for centuries have start to reconcile some of those questions. None of them are perfect. You know, they've all got their own challenges, of course. It's a jigsaw, not a silver bullet. But I think it's a conversation. Well, could we have more cooperatives as part of the economic space in a country, you know, part of the economy? That's the sort of getting towards a well-being economy there. Could we have more social enterprises where they're purposed in a way where they've got social and environmental goals at their forefront? And they're commercially successful, they're commercially viable, they're financially feasible, and they're still trading and operating in markets and so on. But they are doing so for a different reason and a different purpose. And I think there's a lot flourishing in that space around new business model space, to the extent that Harad Sabiti from Harbin has described this as the new fourth sector. There are so many different business models emerging. You've got, the B Corp at one end, and then at the other end, you've got the really radical economy for the common good agenda and all this diversity in between. So there's a lot of opportunities out there to try to transform how we design, purpose and govern our businesses so that we can bring that sense of social and environmental goals into the very heart of business, rather than waiting till 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Oh, we've made some money, let's sprinkle some crumbs down and give back at the end and, you know, try to fix the harm that we've done.
Yeah. And I think it's really interesting. I know that you don't like what's the one thing that you would do type questions.
I know why people ask it though, because I want to get on with stuff.
Well, so they do, but I'm going to make a suggestion here from what you've just said based on this emerging fourth sector. It's like, if you are truly serious about wanting to create a well-being economy, find a way that the world works, one of the first things that you can do is go and look for inspiration within this emerging fourth sector to gain some ideas that will help you ask the questions that will help you adjust what you're doing.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Because often people say, well, what can I do? And I think everyone has their own different sphere of influence. I think conversations are actually, that's often what I end up asking when I get asked that question. People say, what can I do? Well, yes, look at your voting, look at your investments, maybe look at your purchases. But also have more conversations. And because in the last few decades, the economics discussions in places like the UK have been, I think, constrained by what I call a narrow cognitive bandwidth. Essentially, we've been told business as usual is the only option. Of course, we have to grow the economy. That's the only way to deliver quality of lives for people. And you know, we can't do anything differently. And we have to have businesses that are, you know, profitable and, you know, return loads to shareholders very quickly. And, you know, we've been told this is the only option. And so social policy then has been left to act as a sticking plaster to the damage that's been done through that model. We celebrate our success when we redistribute slightly through taxes and transfers the huge gap that's opened up between rich and poor. Anti-poverty charities pat themselves on the back when they can eke out an extra £5 or £10 a month in social protection provided to low-income families. Or we celebrate when we have to clean up after a flood or an oil spill. And all of those examples are what I would perhaps critique as downstream sort of amelioration activities that would be called failure demand. They're driven by our failure to get things right. In environmental thinking, people, ecological economists, talk about defensive expenditures and whether it's there's, you know, spending on top-up wages because people are still working for their poverty, whether it's food banks, whether it's huge numbers of security guards at football matches because we cannot go and play football, you know, have two teams playing football together without fighting each other. It's just, there are so many examples of this downstream spending. And so I think we've got to have this conversation now, and I think Corona demands that, of where we can design things differently first time round so we're not creating all that damage. And I think, yeah, the business model is a micro iteration of the conversation we have to have at the macro level of the economy.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it applies to health as well. You know, that's the familiar saying of prevention is better than cure. So we're all being encouraged to be healthier. I mean, really, I suppose what you're saying here is, how do we actually just make every single part of the world that we live in healthier?
Exactly. I have this dream that one day we'll have politicians going into an election campaign saying, on my watch, there'll be 1,000 fewer policemen and there'll be 1,000 fewer nurses because people will be kept healthy and safe in their communities from the beginning. I mean, I think that would be extraordinary if we shifted the conversation around that. I mean, the challenge is, though, if we're good at prevention, GDP might actually go down because so much of what we count by as gross domestic product increases are that expensive downstream treatment. Even applies to individuals. So there's a wonderful French economist called Serge Latouche, very radical sort of degrowth thinker. But he talks about consolation goods, the consolation goods that we spend our money on. I mean, gosh, a lot of people now, you know, myself included, the Friday night bottle of wine at the end of a week on Zoom calls and terrified about the state of the world. I mean, but you've seen that across, you know, society for a long time, people consoling themselves through stressed, precarious, alienated, you know, lives. The term retail therapy has been coined for a reason. So it applies at all levels of systems, individuals, businesses, and at the, you know, the governmental macroeconomy level.
Yeah. And I think it's fascinating there because what you're talking about is what we're all doing individually is actually what's happening on a bigger scale. And I think it's sometimes so hard for us to understand that. Yeah, I was speaking to, I can't remember which guest it was, but what they blew me away was with energy efficiency. And they were talking about a tea company who had done an analysis of their entire supply chain to find out which was the biggest use of energy. And actually where it came from was everybody actually filling their kettles up too full to use the tea bags. And that just, you know, that blew my mind because in some ways, we've had this story put of us, we're only one person, what can you do? We're only one person, what can you do? But wait a minute, if I'm one person in a bigger system and what I'm doing is representative of the bigger system, then as an individual, I have far more power than I truly think that I do have.
But what you're talking about there is sort of the pushing towards new norms and tipping points. So there's a book I had out last year, a quote, I think it's someone from Goldman Sachs, if I remember rightly, saying, well, Goldman Sachs doesn't care if you raise chickens. Well, if everyone started raising chickens, then you're starting to move the market and Goldman Sachs would start to care or its equivalent. And I think there is something about people emulating good practice and on its own, it might feel just a tiny little, you know, into the wind, but when others start to replicate it and we know that how social practices change are not from celebrity endorsements, they're from people emulating their friends and their neighbors. And so you stopping to, you know, fill your kettle up, you know, people come around to your house when we're no longer on lockdown and they see that and they're things that people start to emulate. You know, the way now the sort of the raised eyebrow you used to have if someone had too many plastic shopping bags rather than reusables. I mean, that's what a turnaround very quickly. And people often like citing the drink driving, how quickly norms can change. And yes, that had policy and advertising, but it also has become a different way of looking at what's appropriate behavior in society. So yeah, things can change quickly. And individuals, there's also something important, I think, about individual action for people feeling they have agency in an overwhelming sort of existential systemic challenge. If you're doing little things, at least you feel you are part of the solution. And it also signals to government that people, their constituents, are taking this seriously too. So individual actions may not on their own add up, but one when they start to become, you know, move towards a tipping point, when they signal to government and when they help people feel agency, then I think they're really, really significant.
Mm, yeah, love that, a powerful reminder. So we were talking about well-being economy, having this ability to redefine what we value and create this vision of a different world. So I was curious of what's the relationship between the sustainable development goals and the well-being economy? Are they similar? Is there differences? Are they both pointing to the same vision?
We'd have people in our membership and in the wider movement who would love the SDGs and say, these are fantastic. They are a step change. They're brilliant. There were others who would say, I don't want to talk about the SDGs. They're flawed. They don't go far enough. And I think in a way, they're probably both right. I mean, the critique that I think is rightly leveled at the SDGs is around, particularly from the sort of sustainability perspective, is around SDG 8 with the goal of growth and saying what people, I think, right, fairly critiquing, saying some of the other goals are going to be undermined if we keep pursuing growth as a goal for the economy, because all the evidence is how tightly coupled economic growth is with environmental impact. And yes, theoretically you can decouple it, but we cannot, it's just, we're seeing in practice, it's either signs of decoupling are either missing offshoring or they're not fast enough in the timescale that we need. So, you know, decoupling is a nice theoretical possibility. It's a nice technical fantasy. But if we're really going to make the changes we need in time, then we have to talk about this economic growth agenda. So I think a lot of the critique around the SDGs hones in on that. And I think there are other critiques that perhaps feminists would make about some of the goals in the objectives. What I like about the SDGs is the holistic nature of them, and particularly that quite beautiful underlying phrase of leave no one behind. I mean, I think we should have a conversation about maybe some people are too far ahead and doing a bit of damage as they race out far ahead. But I think that's beautiful. What we've seen, I think, is just how so many businesses are finding the SDGs a really useful framework for mapping and understanding their different impact and the layers and spheres of how their activities impact across a wider set of objectives. What makes me uncomfortable is when people have a conversation along the lines of, oh, pick your favourite SDG. And I think that undermines the holistic nature and how they're actually all interconnected. I mean, they are there, and I certainly point to them when I'm having a conversation with someone I think who knows is interested in the SDGs, but I will certainly always recognise that they're not perfect, but nothing is. And if we kept waiting for the perfect, we will never get anywhere, and the world will implode before we get to it.
Yeah, no, and I really appreciate you sharing that, because I know for me, I mean, I use the SDGs in a lot of my work with clients, and for me, it's that holistic framework. And, you know, the way that I look at it is there are so many criticisms of the SDGs, and yet 1,500 people who've put work together to come up with something that's a starting point is better than saying I'm going to go into this blind and we can course correct, you know, because I have criticisms when I look at it and I'm like, well, with my work and nature and coaching with nature, and I look at all the targets, I'm like, you're missing something about nature and this relationship between humans and nature within it. You know, the only representation that I can find is in SDG 12, which is responsible consumption and production. And it says, you will educate people to live lifestyles in harmony with nature. And I'm like, but what about the health and well-being benefits that we get from nature? You have no mention of this within the SDGs. And yet, owning that criticism, I'm like, well, that gives me an opportunity at some point to campaign for that when I'm in a stronger position to say this is what we need to take into, because how then does this change the system? And that for me is an important point.
And I guess from that perspective, probably the wellbeing economy agenda goes a little bit further in one, being very explicit about the embedded nature of the economy as a subset of society and nature, as we spoke about earlier, just saying, you know, it's not about the pillars or the equal pillars, or let alone, God help us, as we've had in the past, society and nature as an input to the economy. It's really that embedded reality is something that's really at the core, but also really recognizing that a wellbeing economy is one that's regenerating the environment. And that's a very bold, ambitious. It's not just do no harm. It's not just be sustainable. It is actually regenerate and become positive in the impact. And I think that's a much more ambitious goal than just the sort of more timid sustainability space. I mean, there's obviously a spectrum of how sustainability is understood. But I think that regenerative space, and there's a lot of work being done around how, what's that mean in terms of how we do farming and agriculture and business design to embed those principles. And I think it just comes back to the duality of questions of social justice with nature. For us, we talk about climate change as being a social justice issue, not just in its cause. You know, who is it who's putting most pressure on the planet? It's, if you look at the evidence, it's the wealthiest. But also who is most hit? It's the poorest, the most vulnerable. And so there's, you know, social justice question is deeply embedded in environmental questions. And if we're going to have solutions to environmental questions and start to attend to the environmental breakdown, those solutions have to have social justice at their core, because they won't get anywhere. They won't get anywhere. And I think that's a critique that's, I think, quite rightly been leveled at the environment movement to date, is that they haven't, and this is a big sweeping comment, there's huge exceptions to this, but writ large haven't sufficiently paid attention to the social justice questions. And one of the, I'd say, really odious examples of that we're seeing with Corona is some environmentalists celebrating Corona. And now, yes, we are seeing some environmental benefits. That is not a reason to celebrate Corona. And the UN General Secretary has said recently, we won't solve climate change through a virus. And I completely agree with him. It might give us some hints and give us an opportunity for a different debate, that's very different from celebrating. And so I think we need to remember that it's come back to the social justice questions at the same time of our environmental conversations.
Yeah, I think you've touched on a really important point there, because I've noticed that as well. And, you know, I was talking about my first master's, and that was very much the extreme viewpoints that were there. You know, humans were eco-zombies. And I thought, you know, how can you be saying that we're part of nature, but then criticizing people for not acting in a specific way? And it's this unification, which is what I love about the well-being economy, that it brings the two together, and it blurs the boundaries of separation between us and nature.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've always puzzled that sort of inherent human need for nature. And so nature obviously has an intrinsic value, so I wouldn't be anthropocentric and saying it's just about the, you know, the human benefit from nature. But I've always been fascinated how in cities, where are the best houses, the most expensive houses? They're the ones with the harbour view. I mean, there's even in sort of the commercial sense, people need to feel that they can see water and nature. There's something really primal about human beings needing to be, and you see this, all the evidence in when hospitals are designed where every patient can look out on a tree, recovery is faster. The challenge is, we know there's a big socioeconomic gradient in terms of who gets to access nature in normal times, and more profoundly now during lockdown, that it's, you know, it is the wealthiest parts of cities, the wealthiest households who have backyards, whose the parks near them are probably clean and safer than those in low-income communities. And so no wonder we see these layers of health inequality. So it just goes back to our original part of this conversation around the systemic nature of all these questions and how they're all interlinked, and all that, you know, you can't prize them apart, which makes it hard to work on, but you've got to start somewhere.
Totally. So speaking of nature, what is your most favourite memory of a time or place in nature, and why?
So I grew up in Australia, in the capital city, Canberra, which is called, the nickname is the bush capital. There's hills everywhere. And so first memories would be out in the local mountains, local bush camping, and, you know, the smell of campfires, the smell of eucalyptus. What I really miss being away from Australia is that smell of eucalyptus after the rain. I mean, it's just one of the most extraordinary, and the sound of rain on eucalyptus. And I actually call myself a pluviophile, which sounds really pretentious, but it means lover of rain. And I think growing up in a drought-stricken country, you really recognise very quickly the life-giving qualities of rain. And, you know, Scots, where we're based now, Scots are always complaining about the rain. But to me, if it's raining, it makes me feel happy and peaceful. So I have so many memories. And I think probably most Australians would, actually, because we're so lucky in Australia to have such awesome, accessible natural landscape. So it'll be camping with my family in the local hills.
Mm, and I like that. So you mentioned that camping and the family, the fire around the fire, the smell of the eucalyptus trees, the rain. I mean, how do experiences like this inform and inspire the work that you're doing today?
I think probably implicitly, in that my journey into the wellbeing economy space has been from the social justice perspective. But I think implicitly there is recognition of cherishing nature. And on the We All website, where we've got our team profiles, my colleague Lisa, who put them together, asked us all for a quote, just one quote. And the one I've put in there, I think, is Ernest Hemingway. He said, "The world is a fine place worth the fighting for." And I think that's why I'm fighting, to sort of try to do what I can in my small way to make the world a better place, because there is something extraordinarily wonderful about this world in a humanity space, but also from the perspective of just how physically beautiful and extraordinary nature is. And I do think what's lovely about people today, as we, you know, we're in lockdown, just seeing how quickly nature regenerating, what an extraordinary, almost a miracle of life that is. So there's something really profoundly amazing about the nature and environment.
Even my mum said that this morning. You know, we were out for our daily walk. She's like, "It's amazing, you know, how the world is changing and nature is recovering." And I was like, "Ooh, we're getting quite deep and philosophical this morning, mum." But just that appreciation. And what I hope is that us people are listening to this, knowing that, fingers crossed, we're hopefully emerging out of lockdown as this goes live, that we're taking our experiences and holding on to them and really asking ourselves this question of what is the vision of the world that we now want to create as we emerge from the cocoon, I suppose, is a nice nature metaphor there. So I'm preempting my last question here, Catherine, by saying that's what I want people to take away from this interview. But what do you want people to take away from our conversation today?
I guess the sense of hope that we don't need to return to business as usual, that there are lots of examples already of ways of doing things differently in politics, in business, in lifestyles, in our own daily lives. And I think a sense of hope that there are options, there are alternatives. And I guess I'd also hope that people can communicate that in their own spaces, that they can, when they hear their local politicians saying, we need to get back to business as usual, they can write them a letter, or if they're at a meeting saying, well, hang on a minute, business as usual was not very good for people and planet. We need something different. So I hope people can feel optimistic that they can be part of what we're saying, building back better, that they can be part of an effort to build back better to a well-being economy, rather than think the best we can do is return to what we had before, because what we had before was pretty rubbish in so many respects.
And I like that. So let's hold on to the hope and take the action to build back better. Thank you so much for joining me today, Catherine.
My pleasure.
Earth Self offers strategic development aligned with the UN Sustainable Development Goals, leadership, team, business, and organizational coaching with nature, and trains coaches in our transformational change coaching with nature approach. Find out more at www.earthself.org.